Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm John Purcell. I'm sitting across from Peter Fitzsimons to talk about his brilliant new book, Monash's masterpiece, The Battle of Lehmel and the 93 Minutes That Changed the World. Welcome, Peter.
John, always good to be with you. Is this an audio or visual?
It's an audio.
Only audio.
You can be as relaxed as you can pick your nose, you can do whatever you like.
Good. Okay, let's rock and roll.
Yeah. So this is, you've done radio before, haven't you?
I live for radio. I love radio.
Yeah. Well, this is called a podcast. Very different.
Good.
Very different. So this this guy, Monash, who is he?
That's a very interesting question. He's one of those people that most Australians that have been here a fair while recognise the name Monash. They either went to Monash University, they've read Monash books.
Lived in Monash Street.
Monash Street, Monash Electorate. Maybe they're a part of the Monash Forum, or they've read, you know, they've bits and pieces about Monash. So he's a famous Australian. What he actually did, a lot of people are a bit vague about. And I must say, I would say 3 or 4 years ago, I was a bit vague about it. But then you get into who this bloke was, what he did. He was extraordinary. So he was born in Jerilderie. He was asked in 1929 who was the most famous person he'd ever met. What he was quoted as saying that the most famous person he'd ever met was Ned Kelly, because the story was he was there as a 14-year-old boy from Scots College in Melbourne, and he'd met Ned Kelly and talked to Ned Kelly for a couple of minutes and was transfixed by Ned Kelly. But what he was an engineer, and he was a brilliant engineer down Victoria Way, built a lot of bridges. I think there are 80 bridges that had John Monash as the person who solved the logistical problems, worked out how to bring the arches together so they matched perfectly, crossed the river and stand ever after. And he was at that point, prior to the war, involved in the militia. So he wasn't regular army. He wasn't somebody that was making a career out of the army. The army was on the sideline. The
war. So what's this militia? Is it like the reserve?
Militia, well, if you like, the reserve. Yeah. Not a version of weekend warriors, if you will.
Yeah.
But not the full-time regular army who's devoted their lives to it. He had a career completely apart from the army. Then the war breaks out. He rises very quickly through the ranks. He was at Gallipoli. And again, I haven't got the book before me, but I remember being stunned coming across a quote in my Gallipoli book. I think it was, for some reason, I think I remember it, 26th of June 1915, Monash wrote in his diary something like, "One day the word Gallipoli will have great resonance. People will speak of it with great respect. This will be sacred ground." I mean, at that time, he was in a horrible shithole, which was Gallipoli at the time. But he was a man of great vision, great foresight.
So if he's been building bridges and the like, how old is he?
That's a very good question, I imagine.
So like in his 40s or 50s?
Yes, late 40s, because I think in Hamel he was in his early 50s, so that would make sense. But just past middle age, basically. And so then he rises, they put him in charge of the 3rd Division, they go really well on the Western Front. He's a man that is a brilliant leader of men. And he's got a very fine intellect. And so by 1918, he was in the front line of Australian generals when this extraordinary idea started to take hold. And this extraordinary idea was, you know what? We've got Australian soldiers. We're a part of the Australian Army Corps. What do you reckon, instead of having an Englishman in charge, what do you think? We have an Australian. Outcry. Outrageous. I mean, dare I say, as current chair of the Australian Republic movement, not unlike the current system now. You know, we are living in Australia. We're Australian people. We're beneath the Southern Cross. What do you say that our head of state doesn't come from a family living in England, but is one of them? Outrageous! That's outrageous! We can't do that. We've got to have a family of English aristocrats. And there was a strong view at the time. May 1918, leading into Monash's appointment, although I think he was appointed, again, I wrote the book 6 months ago, but mid-April, I think the appointment came through again. I think I remember it, maybe he was informed on the 11th of April that he would get the position. But he had to overcome several things to become the commanding officer of the Australian Corps. And the first one was, anti-Semitism. He was Jewish, and not particularly religious Jewish, you know, not particularly an absolute devotee of the Jewish religion, but certainly a Jewish man, a proud Jewish man. And there was a great deal of anti-Semitism. Basically, we can't have a Jew in charge. And I go into it in the book. And Charles Bean was certainly a part of opposition to his appointment, as was, and I'm a great admirer of Charles Bean, and I'm also a great admirer of Keith Murdoch, who was the most influential journalist of the day and had the ear of the politicians. And both Murdoch and Keith Murdoch and Charles Bean united to try to stop him, but the appointment went through anyway. And Monash took over, became the commanding officer of the Australian Corps on the 30th of May 1918. And immediately there was a new way of doing things. And, you know, I go back to my book the second book of my trilogy, which was Villers-Bretonneux, which was Fromelles and Pozières, which went into the 1st of July 1916, when the Brits went over the top, the beginning of the Battle of the Somme. 60,000 casualties, British casualties on the first day, 20,000 men went down. And at that point, here's the plan. I'm in my trench, you're in your trench. I'm going to get my men to get in the trenches with their rifles. I'm going to blow the whistle, and I want thousands of my men to go over the top. Any nuances to this plan? No, that's just the plan. You run. I want so many of you to run at their machine guns that they can't shoot us all, and some will come out at the other end, and we'll win the day. And that's where, on the 1st of July 1916, 20,000 brave British soldiers went to their deaths. And Monash was when he took over, his first point was, we're not doing it like that anymore. We are not simply going over the top and running at their guns. And he wanted, his basic idea was to use his engineering knowledge to attack, to crack the German line on the Western Front as a logistical exercise. And so the first thing that was obvious to him was, I want tanks. Now tanks, the first time tanks had ever been used was in the Battle of Villers-Bretonneux. You'd had a tank-on-tank battle, was in the Battle of Villers-Bretonneux in April of 1918. There were many Australian soldiers who were appalled by tanks because they'd been let down in the Battle of Bullecourt. And Monash wanted the men to get confidence in tanks, so he arranged for the tank battalion to come forward, for the men to get familiar with the tanks, to believe in the tanks, to work out how they could operate with the tanks. And so he came up with this extraordinarily sophisticated battle plan. I think they call it an all-arms battle, basically integration of all the weaponry they have. And the idea prior to that, you had generals who would, the military culture was, I'm the general, you're the colonel. Here are your written orders. Your men will go over the top. And I mean, the classic example of that was Battle of Fromelles, which appalls me still, where the great General Pompey Elliott was given orders for his men to go over the top. And, you know, the plan was for his men to charge 400 yards in searing daylight straight at German guns. And British Major Howard and said, what do you think will happen to my men if they go over the top following your orders? He said, I don't like to answer questions. I'm asking you what will happen. Well, if you ask me, I think that'll be a bloody Holocaust. And that's what it was. So 2 years on from there, it's Monash who is saying, we're not going to do it like that. And it's not simply because I'm the general that I know best. Here is the plan that I've come up with to get the tanks forward.
Before that, I was reading a brilliant book called Monash's Masterpiece.
Mm. My book.
That book, yeah. About the way in which he was already, before he became the leader of the whole lot, how he's already encouraging the Australians to do these little raids at night time, and the Germans were terrified of
it. You actually have read it, yes.
There you go, look at that.
Yes.
He's changed, he's already messing around with how things are done.
Yes, to keep them off balance,
yeah.
to work out, and a large part of that.
And to keep his men hungry.
To keep his men hungry. And his great line was, I want to feed my men on victory.
Yeah.
And it's a great line. Mm. And it basically was, give them small victories so that they, you know, if you give them carrots bit by bit, they'll start to love carrots. Mm. And they'll have confidence that they can get the carrots. But yes, feed my men on victory was to arrange for them to, you know, have them get experience in winning. And but the point I was getting to was he was a humble man in that it wasn't I'm the general, you're the colonel, do it my way. He came up with this sophisticated plan. He put all of the people involved around the table so they could thrash it out. And the essence of the sophistication of his plan was, we're going to need the tanks to do the hard work. But hang on, how do we get the tanks forward without the Germans being aware that they're there? So we need element of surprise. Well, we're going to have at exactly 10 p.m. on the night of the 3rd of July, we'll have planes roar very low over the German lines. There'll be so much noise that under the cover of that darkness, we'll move them forward. We'll get them into position half a mile back. Then at exactly 3:02 a.m. We'll start the first of the artillery barrage so that they again a lot of noise to move the tanks even closer. It'd be useful if we could have the Germans wearing gas masks. Well, how are we going to do that? Well, like Pavlov's dogs. I mean, it's fascinating. He had for two weeks leading up to the battle, he had artillery barrage on the Germans and mixed with gas. So the Germans at 3 o'clock every night for 2 weeks. Here it comes, Fritz. More artillery. Oh, quick, put the gas masks on. So on the night in question, he hits them with the barrage. This time, no gas, but the Germans put on the gas masks. So right away, and again, why at 3 a.m., 3:02 a.m. did it start? Because after much discussion, they worked out that they would be attacking. Obviously, they'll be attacking. They attacked the German line at Hamel from the west, so they're coming towards the rising sun. And why is this perfect? So that the Germans that they were attacking would be silhouetted against the dawn, but they would be coming from the darkness. Brilliant. And so it was exactly 3:02 a.m. that they begin, 3:10 a.m. and in that first barrage the tanks start to move forward, and they work out a precise way so that the creeping barrage of artillery will advance 100 yards every 10 minutes, etc., etc. So he comes up with this extraordinarily sophisticated plan, and it was meant to take 90 minutes. And as a way of measuring just how extraordinary this battle was, prior to this, they'd had the Battle of Pozieres, which is a famous Australian battle. In the course of that battle, over 6 weeks, Australia had advanced 2 miles and lost 6,800 men. So that was, you know, that's you pay for every yard in blood. And in this particular battle, the thing was, this will go at exactly 90 minutes. When the shooting was over, they had advanced 1.5 miles, which is exactly how much Monash had wanted them to advance, because Monash had realised by studying, by using his intellect, that most times you did a raid, you'd go as far forward as you could till you ran out of gas. Then the Germans would gather themselves and push you back. So you'd be like a spring, an uncoiled spring. You'd go out as far as the spring could go, and then you'd have to pull back. Monash said, we're not going to do it like that. Go exactly 1.5 miles. This is the position I want. When you get there, dig in. That will be the new land. So this time, it wasn't a 90-minute battle. It was a 93-minute battle. And they advanced 1.5 miles and they lost 300 men. I mean, just unbelievable. And this became the model that was used throughout the war. I don't know, given your reading of it, have you come across the story of Two Guns Harry Dalziel? Well, that's of the stories. You know, there's sort of, you're going through diaries and you're going through letters and you're reading these accounts. And my favourite of the lot was a guy called Two Guns Harry, and he was known as Two Guns Harry for the obvious, you'll never guess why, because he had a pistol in both belts, and he was basically, the way I envision him, he was a guy that talked himself up, and basically he was that they, you know, that come, you know, just give me a gun, let me at these guys, let me at them, I'll take their fucking heads off, I'll shoot them down, etc., etc. And he was an infantry, he was in the transport in the lead up to the battle, and a significant part of this battle was, for the first time, the Americans were going to be involved. And it's interesting, if you've been raised on Tom Hanks movies, as I have, and John Wayne movies, and you read the American literature, you pretty much have the impression the Americans, you know, they pretty much knocked over the First World War, and we Australians were allowed to accompany them, you know, for the and the fact is, if you think that the war started in the latter part of 1914 and finished in 11th of November 1918, the Americans didn't get to grips, you know, actual in attacking, you know, aggression, not just defensive moves, but actually thrown into battle to attack until the 4th of July 1918. So they're only there for the last months, but these guys, they were under Monash. So Monash got 2,000 troops, and at the last minute, 1,000 American troops were pulled out, but Monash kept 1,000 troops. They went into battle under Australian command. Anyway, given that they suddenly lost 1,000 troops on the eve of the battle, they suddenly need anybody they can get. And so one of them was Two Guns Harry Dalziel. And this is my favourite part, that anyway, come the time, they're advancing, you know, and up and move, and the whistle blows, and they go and they attack the Germans, and they clean them out of the first trench, and they clean them out of the second trench and Pear Trench. And in the platoon that Two Guns Harry is in, they suddenly come under fierce rat-a-tat-tat machine gun fire, and they're rucked and far from home. They got to hit the ground. And suddenly, this guy who's been talking about how good he's going to be, what he's going to do, Two Guns Harry, he's on his feet. He fires his pistol. He runs left, he runs right, he runs forward, he shoots one, he shoots two, he shoots three. He basically lives out everything that he'd ever said he was going to do. He did it. And he's... It's funny we live this so intensely. I've forgotten how much I'd love this story, even if the details aren't quite as tight as they should be. But he gets shot. He takes out the machine gun nest. He's ordered, he'd taken a bullet, I think he'd had a finger shot off. He was ordered to retire. He refused to retire. He kept ferrying supplies back and forth. And right near the end of the battle, right when, you know, victory is about to be theirs and all the glory for Two Guns Harry, there's a German soldier in the gloom. You know, they're gone. The men have shattered force. But he lines up this distant figure in the gloom, which proves to be Two Guns Harry. He pulls the trigger, boom, hits him, blows the side of the skull of Two Guns Harry off, and down he goes. And then when the dawn comes, it's always that scene after the battle. They, even though there's only 300 dead, there's still 300 dead, and you know, they need a mass grave. So it's a very sobering duty that they've got to do to... It's a very sobering duty that they've got to start to bury their dead. And there, you know, it's a really shocking thing. There is the hero of the men, Two Guns Harry, dead as a dodo. And one man grabs his arms and one man grabs his legs, and they're about to swing him into the mass grave when... he coughs. He's still alive. They get him back to the regimental aid post. They start to patch him together, and he gets back to Australia. He suffered headaches. His kids, he wouldn't let his kids jump all over him when he was in the swimming pool or the dam because he couldn't get his head too wet. But he died. Was it in 65 or 82? One of those two. But he died 50 years later.
Yeah.
And just a fantastic story of somebody who'd fought the good fight, went on to live an extraordinary life. And, you know, those are the sort of stories that I love to bring to life. And he won the Victoria Cross. It was awarded the Victoria Cross, earned the Victoria Cross.
Can I get a bit of a political question right at the end here? So today in the, I think it's The Guardian, one of the newspapers, but I think he spoke at the press club, Richard Flanagan was sort of talking about the role of Anzacs in the Australian environment. And as a leader of the Republican movement, the figurehead of the Republican movement.
I'm not the figurehead of the Republican movement. The figurehead's like a hood ornament. But I'm on the executive. I get to help decide.
Okay. Where do you think the role of Anzac history? Because to my mind, it was sort of John Howard that kind of rebirthed the Anzac history in the 90s. But you've been looking at the actual men who were there, and a lot of people don't do that. They have an idea of this.
One time when I was on Neil Mitchell's show on 3AW, I was appalled because I'd been talking about Ned Kelly, and about 5 minutes to go, a guy called up. It was a policeman, you know, and he said to me, "How dare you? You're glorifying a cop killer. You're glorifying Ned Kelly. You know, and I'm not glorifying Ned Kelly. I'm telling you, this is what happened. And I take the same approach with my war stuff. I don't want to glorify it. I want to say this was appalling. You know, we're a nation of 4 million people. We sent away 333,000 men, 151,000 were wounded, 60,000 killed. Killed! And of those, 47,000 lie in France. And so when I go into this stuff, I suppose I was raised on not war stories at all. Mum and Dad didn't tell war stories particularly, but I was very aware that Dad had served at El Alamein and been a member of the 2nd 4th ACAC, and served proudly in the Second World War, and we went to Anzac Days, and my mother served in the army as a physiotherapist come nurse, and physio, and helped putting soldiers back together. So I had a sort of respect for war as I grew up, but it was only when I, like most Australians of my generation and most Australians, still 95% of what I knew about what happened in Australia's military past started at dawn on the 25th of April 1915 and faded by sundown, because we tell the Gallipoli story over and over again. So when I first went into the Western Front, I don't know what propelled me particularly to do From Ellen Pozier, but somehow or other it came up and I looked and I went, Jesus, that's an amazing story. When you get into it, it's stunning. And what the Australians did in 1918 is unbelievable. And so it is something like, if we are, I think, given how many war dead we have, it is right and it is proper that we, their heirs, know what they did. Given the tragedy of the time, we should know what went wrong, how we got into this position. We shouldn't celebrate it, but we should commemorate it. And for me, Peter Broon, who's a friend of mine, who is a great writer from South Australia, has written a lot of war stories. In one of his books, he made a really good point, and he talked about the arbitrary nature of those that are remembered who die in wartime. And his basic point, I'm not being as eloquent as he was, but he talked about how there is many a soldier, brave Australian soldier, that lies forgotten in a lost ditch, in a battle long forgotten, every bit as brave as the soldier that died at Gallipoli. Mm. And it's a brilliant point. And I've always been, when he made that point in one of his books, and I've always commended him for it and written about it. When I go into the Western Front, I was never interested in the Western Front. I never understood what happened at the Western Front. But when you go into what happened at the Western Front, it was fucking extraordinary. And the Australians, from the 23rd of March onwards, well, they didn't get involved, I think, till 26th, 27th of March, 1918. But they fought. The Germans were coming on. They'd brought the soldiers back from the Eastern Front in Russia. Double or nothing, they attacked. And instead of making 50 yards, they make 5 miles, 10 miles, 15 miles. They're getting close to Amiens. If Amiens falls, the war will be in the balance, because Amiens was the railway hub town for the British Army. 60% of munitions, materiel and men went through Amiens. They get to the edge of Villers-Bretonneux. The Australians throw them back. They get into Villers-Bretonneux. The Australians throw them out. The Australians, when everything was crumbling around them, in April of late March, April of 1918, the Brits were brave but shattered. They, it was the end of 4 years of warfare from them. The Australians were thrown into battle, and in 6 weeks they fought 12 battles and they didn't cede an inch. They never, ever retreated. And, I look at that as an Australian 100 years later and go, Jesus wept, how did they do that? How did the French were falling back, the Brits were falling back, the Canadians were falling back. Somehow, and it's not vainglorious, it's just, it's there. It is, the Australians didn't back off. And I do feel that should be honoured, that should be known. I do think when you have the war dead we do, I deeply admire Richard Flanagan, I think he's a brilliant writer, and I was very interested in his National Press Club speech, but I differ from him in that I think that the Monash Centre, Sir John Monash Centre in Villers-Bretonneux, it is right and it is proper that 100 years later we remember. Now, people have also said to me, well, what about the frontier wars? And I must say, that is a book I intend to get to. I want to do that. I also think we should know a lot more than we do about Pemulwuy, about Aboriginal resistance across the country.
Thank you very much, Peter, for coming in and talking about it in your book. We're very excited, and I think it's an absolute must on the shelf of anyone who loves history, who is interested in the story behind these sort of great moments in history, because that's one of the things that we all admire about your writing, is not only those little nuggets like the two-gun guy, but there's sort of little backstories that really fill in those sort of great.
Well, areas. I'm always told by my publisher Matthew to only plug one book at a time. But I tell you what, I love Monash's masterpiece, but coming up for Christmas, I've also got Mutiny on the Bounty. You want to talk anecdotes, Mutiny on the Bounty, God help me, that is going to be a cracker book.
As I said a million times, if it's not focusing on William Purcell, I'm not reading it. I want a nice big chunk for that annoying bastard. Thank you very much for coming in, Peter.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.